Today is Friday, March 5th, 2021. This is part 9 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Pat Gredigan, spelled G-R-E-D-I-A-G-I-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good evening, Pat. How are you today?
I'm doing quite well, thanks.
Great. Pat, we concluded part 8. Around 2001, you were the River District Ranger at Dinosaur National Monument, and you applied out for a job at Sequoia Kings Canyon. Can you pick that back up again?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to describe the structure of that park area a little bit, and then I'll tell you what job I applied for and got.
Great.
Sequoia and Kings Canyon are two separate national park units, but they are adjacent to each other. They have a shared boundary, and they are administered by the Park Service as one single area. So there's one superintendent that is in charge of both parks,
Okay. And
there's one chief ranger that's in charge of both parks as well as some other programs, and there's one chief of maintenance who's over stuff in both parks. And then it starts breaking down from there in terms of who's responsible for what. And the district ranger job that I applied for and got, which was Sequoia District Ranger, is of a different magnitude than the district ranger jobs that we've been talking about so far, because in the past interviews, the district was a subunit of one single park. And so maybe there was three or four subunits, and the district I was involved with was one of those. In Sequoia Kings Canyon, each park was called a different district. So there was only two district rangers. There was a district ranger in charge of law enforcement, backcountry, and fee collection operations in Sequoia, and one who had that same responsibilities in Kings Canyon.
Okay.
And then it was further, each park had further subdivisions to carry that out. So the job I had was the Sequoia District Ranger, meaning that I oversaw the operations I just described in all of Sequoia National Park. And there were, originally there were four sub-districts with a sub-district ranger heading up each operation in Sequoia. So three of them were more or less front country ones, mountain park front country, but the fourth one was totally back country, where the rangers hiked in and spent the summer in the in a cabin in the back country.
Okay.
So I had responsibility for managing essentially those operations. So it was a big shift, both in terms of the largeness of the job, the magnitude of the job, but also that I wasn't a field ranger at that point. I was an office ranger. And when I got the job and people said, oh, aren't you going to miss being a river ranger? I very clearly remember, no, not. I love rivers, but I wanted something that had a little more challenge to it, and I knew that this new job was going to be more challenge. I'd learn new things, and I'd be involved with different kinds of aspects of working for a national park, and I was really eager to do that. So the fact that I went to essentially a desk job had trade-offs that made it all the worthwhile. So that was what I did in July or something, but sometime in 2001.
Okay.
I took on that job and stayed there for about 3 years doing that work.
So let's step back for a minute. Do you have a rough idea of how many acres are in Sequoia?
I could not even begin to tell you. I never was good at those kinds of...
It's like a million? I mean, is it like Grand Canyon size, or is it a dinosaur size?
Oh, it's much bigger than Dinosaur.
Okay.
Big Bend might be kind of close, because Big Bend's pretty big. It's smaller than the Grand Canyon, I think. It's pretty good size, but much of it is backcountry, and so
right.
the margin of use is along a road on the west side of the park. The east side of the park is the crest of the Sierra Mountains.
Okay.
And on the east side of that crest, and that crest does include Mount Whitney.
Okay.
And the east side of that is Forest Service. So from Mount Whitney and that crest towards the west is where Sequoia National Park is. And it's right along that western edge that it's accessible by road. And so there was points of congregation of road easily accessible areas that got the bulk of the visitation. But there was a massive backcountry area that still needed managing, but it was much less densely visited and not so many rangers, but there were rangers back in there.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of it's like the Grand Canyon in that way too, you know, South Rim, North Rim, and then just lots of acres of light use through much of the rest of the park.
When I think of the Sierra, I think of steep escarpments on the east and
yes.
long gradual
yes.
Drop on the west.
Right.
And with Yosemite kind of off
yes.
to the north.
Yep.
And I guess Kings Canyon would be to the south?
Yeah, between Yosemite and Kings Canyon, there's Forest Service land.
Okay.
And so Kings Canyon, I don't know how many miles. Well, the John Muir Trail runs from Yosemite and curves around a little bit there. It actually becomes part of the Pacific Crest Trail, and it
right.
ends at Mount Whitney,
right.
210 miles or 220 miles. Later.
South.
So, yes, south.
Okay.
And of course, it wouldn't be as a direct arrow
right.
South, but it's probably, I'm going to guess, 100 miles of Forest Service land in between Yosemite, then Kings Canyon, and then adjacent to Kings Canyon is Sequoia. And you're right that it's a sloping elevation on the west side, which is where the giant sequoias live at about 6,000 feet elevation. So
okay.
there's just a lot more moisture on the west side, and the habitat of the park goes from about 2,000 feet up to 14,000 at Mount Whitney.
Right.
So you have all these different ecological niches there, and about 6,000 is where the sequoias are. And there are roads up into that part. Beyond that, it's all hiking.
And was Sequoia handling the permits to hike up to Mount Whitney, or
yes.
was that the Forest Service on the other side?
Well,
the Inyo people.
The Forest Service on the other side did the bulk of that, because there's the by far the most popular way to get to Mount Whitney is to go up from Whitney Portal on the east side and go up to Mount Whitney and then back down that east side, because it's,
yeah.
I don't know, it's like 11 or 14 miles or something like that.
Right.
From the west side, you can hike there, but you've got a few days of hiking before you get close enough to go up. But there was a Park Service ranger that was stationed on the, there's kind of a little extra oomph right there where the crest is. And so you drop down to 11,000 feet, and there was a ranger station, maybe it was 10-5, I think it was about 11,000 feet, on the west side that the Park Service staffed.
Okay.
And that ranger would, with some regularity, go up to the top of Mount Whitney. The Park Service took there was a toilet there in the form of a barrel that was maybe hidden behind some rocks, just so that there was a way for, if somebody needed to defecate, there was
mm-hmm.
a place to do it that it could be hauled off. A helicopter would come in once or twice a year.
Mm.
That ranger would go up there. They'd hook it up while the helicopter was hovering, and then they'd fly it off to a sewage treatment plant somewhere.
Right.
So that became, for some reason, that was the Park Service's. I think the actual little crest was like 40 feet to the east, and so everything on the top is mostly in the Park Service side, so we inherited that toilet responsibility.
Huh. Oh, my gosh. Huh.
Yeah. But I try to make sure I got out into all these sub-districts, Mineral King being one, Lodgepole where the sequoias were being one, and then a lower front country district, and knew what was going on in them. But I loved having to go into the High Sierra for work purposes.
Mm.
I mean, I just found a lot of pleasure in being paid to go hike in the backcountry and see what's going on back there, and I took, advantage of that to make sure I knew what was going on and meet the rangers back there. So that was the real benefit out of that job, was being able to say, I'm going to go on a patrol and check things out. Once or twice a year, maybe, in the backcountry, and have it be all pretty legitimate.
Yeah. Right.
I really enjoyed that job in part because it was a magnificent park, particularly the high country, which caught my attention just because of the grandeur back there, but also because I did get involved with a lot more management of park issues, and it just intrigued my mental capacities to try and, I just learned stuff that I didn't realize was going on at different levels above me. And it's more complex in Sequoia than it was in some other parks. There's wilderness issues that, there was committees to review whether certain mechanized use was okay in the backcountry for administrative purposes. For instance, the Park Service tended to use helicopters to take food into remote cabins high in the sequoias before stock animals could get in there, so that the rangers could go back there and start doing their patrol work. And other agencies, like the Forest Service, tends to not use helicopters in anything that's wilderness. So it was interesting to me just to become more familiar with not only the Wilderness Act, but how it is applied to different agencies, and the reviews that it gets for different uses. You basically have to make your case why you need to use this to do your job in the backcountry. So I really enjoyed learning the stuff. And then I worked with a good staff. I mean, the people I worked with, I really enjoyed, both my boss and the people that were working for me.
Cool.
Debbie Bird was the chief ranger, and I give her a lot of acknowledgement and credit because...
How do you spell her name?
B-I-R-D, Debbie Bird.
Thank you.
And she was actively looking for people with potential to fill the jobs that I got when she was recruiting for them, and not simply somebody who had checked all the boxes and already had a career path that they were working on. And I think because I was female, and because she wanted to make sure that other females got chances to succeed in the Park Service, I think she kind of made a point of hiring me. And I don't know who the other candidates were that she considered, but I feel very fortunate that she was the person doing the selecting, because I think that I might not have been hired if it had been someone else. She gave me a break, and I really was grateful to her for that.
Did Debbie give you your orientation and sort of fill you in? I mean, who handed you the institutional memory from the person you replaced?
I really don't remember. Debbie would have told me some, but Debbie was very busy. She oversaw the fire program, which was a big operation in Sequoia, the wilderness program, which they had a lead wilderness person who did a wilderness plan, two district rangers, a law enforcement specialist, and then she was always working with the superintendent on issues.
Right.
So I'm sure she gave me some kind of orientation, but I think she might have passed it off to the fire of the, I don't remember his title, but anyway, the guy in head of the fire operations, he probably filled me in on that. And the guy in charge of the wilderness, he would have filled me in on those components. So I probably picked up a lot of it from people who had been there and were really knowledgeable about that specific arena.
Okay.
So I don't remember particularly, but I do remember Debbie being very busy, and so I'm not sure she had spent a lot of time with me. And I don't say that negatively. I just acknowledge she had a lot on her plate.
Right, right. Did you know anyone else at Sequoia when you showed up there from your prior Park Service career?
I did not. But there were three of us that were actually hired at the same time. So we were all the Kings Canyon District Ranger, as well as my job as Sequoia District Ranger, as well as actually the Wilderness Coordinator, were all hired at the same time. So we all came in new. And we're kind of friends because we were all new together.
Okay.
And also, we also just naturally worked together a lot. I worked with the wilderness coordinator a lot because a lot of the land that we were responsible for patrolling was wilderness. And actually, it was his office that issued the permits for the backcountry backpacking hikes into wilderness. So that was his responsibility. And then the Kings Canyon District Ranger and I would just collaborate a lot because we had similar issues and, you know, maybe loan staff to each other now and then for different things. So it was easy to integrate into that park. It was people who were knowledgeable and could tell me what was going on and were willing to do so in a friendly manner. And I don't remember how I learned everything, but I remember it just kind of happened and was not a big deal. So I didn't know people, but I found it very easy to integrate in there. So that was good. I really enjoyed that job because it was, like I said, it was a great park and then good people, and then I learned new stuff.
I was just kind of thinking about Dinosaur National Monument. Compared to Sequoia, Sequoia's close to Los Angeles and San Francisco, giant urban centers.
Yeah.
And gosh, I can imagine the backcountry visitation was so much higher.
Yeah. Just a different scale.
Yeah.
Really different scale things.
Yeah. Wow. So tell me, you know, how did your day go? What did you do? You know, what were some of the fun things you got involved in? What were some of the not-so-fun things you got involved in?
Yeah. I think on a day-to-day basis, I was spending a lot of time with looking over reports from what was going on in the different sub-districts. I had budget responsibilities, so I had to allocate that all out and then keep track of how the budget was going. I worked with the Chief Ranger's secretary also on that, but basically I had to be on that. So there were administrative tasks, meetings on this wilderness, how we would use wilderness on grazing. We allowed, there was a horse use component for people who like to take their horses to the backcountry, which is fine, but we had meadows closed until they dried up enough in the spring to withstand horses grazing on them.
Okay.
So we would not issue permits to recreational horse use in the high country until it was deemed that those meadows were ready for that impact. And so I would meet with resource management people about the status of that and when we were going to allow that use back there.
Did you have private tour companies leading guided stock trips?
Let me think about that. Yes, we did have stock people who would go into the park. It was really a very low percentage of the backcountry use.
Okay.
But there were people from the east side that would bring people up that escarpment up to the high country on a trail or two, And I think from the south it would come up to the Golden. Yeah, there was actually, there was day use horses on the west side too, but I think most of the high country horses came out of the east side, and they did have some kind of permit. I can't remember if it was a visitor use permit, or I think that was probably that would have authorized them to conduct that business. I didn't get involved too much with those particular individuals that were running that. It wasn't a very big part of the whole operation, and the sub-district ranger that was in charge of the backcountry, she would have been the lead person that would be in touch with them and just making sure that they knew what the rules were and kind of keeping an eye out on how things were going. But it was never a big component of the use in Sequoia. Nonetheless, it was a use, and they were a vocal set of users because the traditional horse users felt that they were getting squeezed out a little bit by modern park management or the management of parks. In the old days, there was a lot more horse use than there is now in parks because that was how people would get back there with heavier gear, but now a lot more of it's lighter and people backpack. And the park has recognized, I think the Park Service as a whole has recognized that horses have a bigger impact on the natural resources of the backcountry or the front country, but the backcountry in particular, that foot traffic does. And it comes in the form of their hooves chewing up trails at a higher rate of erosion than people feet. It comes with, if they're not using weed-free hay, that they can spread non-native species of grasses in the backcountry. And there was one other thing I was remembering that was, and it comes with them grazing on the park meadows. If that's not done properly, then they can cause a lot of damage when they're wet still. So horses have the potential to do a lot more damage. 10 people on horses have the potential to do a lot more damage than 10 people backpacking in. And the horse users knew that the parks were thinking like that, and they didn't like being kind of on the margin of things or having concerns about the damage that their chosen way of recreation was possibly going to produce and what the park might, you know, do to regulate that. And so they were kind of vocal in making sure that their interests were watched and or were allowed, granted. So, not being a big horse user, but being a big backpacker, I thought that it would be appropriate for me to learn, get a little bit of insight into what it's like to be on a horse trip. And so my sister, who lives in Oregon, is a farrier and has had horses her whole life, and she loves, and she takes her horses to the backcountry all the time. And I said, well, Sue, why don't you come on down, and I'll sign you up as a volunteer, or you just go, and I'll go out with you somehow, and I'll do it on work time. We'll go do a horse trip in the backcountry for 5 days.
Okay.
And you can teach me about what it's like on your end to be a horse user, and what things you like, and what things are, you know, difficult. Another area of potential damage to parks is when horses are just tied improperly to trees, and they can rub the bark off of trees, and so you're supposed to put a high line up and tether your horses in a place that's fairly durable under the high line so that they're standing in one spot all night long isn't going to gouge out big chunks of meadows or something like that. So there's all these little nuances that I knew my sister would know. And we went on, we got a park mule. She's a very good packer as well. And the park loaned us a mule, and we took her two horses because she felt more comfortable with using her horses. And we did this tour, and it was great. But, like, on the third day, the mule got really sick. and we are in the backcountry. And the mule just started not being right and started going downhill real fast.
Oh, my gosh.
Kind of having this vacant stare. And he kept moving with us, but he went to water. He didn't drink. And Sue's going, oh, this is not good. There's something wrong. There's something real wrong with this mule. And so I radioed out and said, you know, something's wrong with Timmy the mule. I always remember Timmy the mule.
Hmm.
And a horse ranger that was assigned to the backcountry and had horse stuff came up and gave the mule a shot of something to hopefully get it cured of whatever might be ailing it. And then we were going to try to go out the next day and shorten our trip and get out, get the mule to a vet. And the mule died the next morning.
Oh, my gosh.
In the backcountry. And so my sister and I loaded up everything on her two horses. Both saddles went on one horse, and then the mule's load went on the other horse. And we walked out, which was no big deal because we like to walk. And we walked out. But meanwhile, we called out that the mule had died, and it died right at the edge of a stream that was in this very popular, not popular meaning lots of people, but it was a destination where people would go to camp, but we didn't want dead mule polluted water.
Mm.
So the trail crew helicoptered in and landed and set a few sticks of dynamite in strategic places and vaporized the mule so that it would deteriorate more mm-hmm. quickly and it wouldn't mm-hmm. just be rotting there all summer long.
Right.
And then we hiked out. Oh, but they wanted to make sure that the mule hadn't had rabies because nobody could figure out what it died from.
Huh.
But we have been trying to cup our hand and give it water with our hand when it was on its last legs, like, come on, drink, Timmy, drink. And so they were concerned that we could have come in contact with rabies if it happened to have rabies.
Mm-hmm.
There was no real indication it did, but they just thought to be safe, they should have it checked. So they cut the head off of Timmy and flew it out in the helicopter, and it was awaiting me in the freezer at the mule barn. And one of the staff that was working in feed collection on didn't have much to do that day. He got the assignment of taking the mule head to the lab somewhere down in Visalia area. It was not rabid. But,
okay.
So that was a very memorable trip. It was very sad, but it was very memorable. And it was good also because my sister went with me on that trip. And
mm-hmm.
so that was a great trip. So that was one of those unusual kind of, not your ordinary day at the office days.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I think about mules at Grand Canyon that every day go up and down the Bright Angel or the Kaibab trails, and the poor trails crew are constantly working on trying to stabilize those trails because of the wear and tear of these large animals.
Yeah.
And so I, kind of never equate it to Sequoia, where the same thing can happen.
Yeah, not to the degree as Grand Canyon, because that gets such specific use all the time. But
yeah, it's year-round almost, so yeah.
Yeah. Livestock is hard on trails. That's just a fact of life.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got them focused on certain trails, and they're going to do more damage there. But So I got a little education about livestock and could speak more knowledgeably when I was at some meeting where we were talking about whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it was largely desk, and I would travel once a week up an hour up the hill to the Lodgepole District and meet with them up there, which is where the sequoias were, and just see. I would go to the different districts and meet with staff and make sure things were just kind of get an update on what's going on and how things were going. And actually went out with the bear crew one time because we had a black bear problem in the campground. Really, it wasn't that we had a problem. It was that the bears had a problem with the Park Service putting the campground in their habitual roaming zone. So.
Yeah.
No, they were there first, and we put a campground there, and they just kept coming through the area. And when dumb people would leave their food out, they were like, well, sure, I'll eat that.
Yeah, you bet.
So we had to work diligently to train the people
mm-hmm.
to keep their food away from the bears. And there was a mother bear that was in the campground, and she had two cubs. And I was there when they decided to try and catch her and move her out because she was teaching her cubs bad things.
Oh, right.
The cubs were up the tree. They were so dang cute. So I did go out and do, you know, tried to make sure I knew what was going on out in the field, and that I was kind of the liaison between the people who were working in the field in these different areas and different activities and what was going on at headquarters, and the policymakers and the budget people knew what we needed and how things were going. And that was probably a pretty good description, actually, of what I was doing. I was that interface between what was going on in the field and people who were never in the field because they were higher grade than I was.
Right, right. Gosh, I just can't. I have a lot of respect for you going into that position, and basically, you know, just trying to learn by getting your boots on the ground.
Yeah.
But I'm learning that it's got to happen a lot in the Park Service when new people take in positions.
Right.
You've got to get out there in the field and try to figure out what's going on and talk to people. And yeah.
And to me, that's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
That's like
yeah.
traveling to a new place and checking it out. It's just, I just kind of figured that everybody's new somewhere, you know, at some point, and it's my turn to be new here, and I'll just figure it out and learn as best I can. And ask people who know better than me to help me. And
yeah. So I'm assuming there must have been a trails crew.
There was a real good trails crew. And when I say real good, I mean that they were interested in rock craftsmanship. I'm trying to think if some of them ended up in the Grand Canyon. I can't remember Grand Canyon folks as much, but these guys were prided themselves on working with granite rock, you know, building crafted rock trails where they needed to do rock work for one reason or another. Really excellent rockmanship, and they took pride in their work, and they were really good.
Yeah, fun.
Yeah.
There can be really amazing works of art there. So.
Yeah, they are.
But subtle, so it doesn't really pop out at you.
Right, and it's only because I kind of knew, had been around these trail crew people in Big Bend. Some of them worked in Big Bend, and I knew that ethic came from the Sierras. I think that might be where it had started and spread, and I had run across it before. And so when I was in the backcountry in the Sierra, I would notice those trails and know that those guys were working hard and really proud of the work they were doing. So they were good. They'd go out for weeks on end in the backcountry just live back there. So
spike camps and
it's a whole subculture back there. Just as you probably recognize that the river runners are a subculture of Grand Canyon users, both commercial river runners and then private or non-commercial, whatever. But the people who hung out in the backcountry as rangers were a total different subgroup that I really had an affinity for, because they were into it because they loved being out in the backcountry, and they were really knowledgeable about the area, and they were really good at what they did, and they were back there for 3 months at a time. Almost never came out. And the trail crew was the same kind of mentality. They loved being back there. They liked doing a good job and doing good work. And I really was very impressed with all the backcountry staff in Sequoia and Kings Canyon. I'm sure I just didn't get to know the Kings Canyon staff the way I got to know the Sequoia staff.
Which makes sense because that was your job. So
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're just the best.
Did you get up Whitney during that time?
I did.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Got up there Actually, I think I did that on a, I did a backpack with my a different sister and a girlfriend. We went up Whitney at that time, but I probably had myself on the clock at that point too, just because I needed to see how, what Whitney was like. But we started on the west side and hiked for 5 days or so, or 6 days. There's something called the High. There's two confusing names, and one's the. Well, I'm not going to even say the name of the trail because I'll confuse it. But there's a trail that goes from the west side up to Whitney, and then we dropped down and went out Whitney Portal. So we did a west-to-east traverse that took probably 6 days, as I'm remembering now. And so that was great to see that whole, as you gained elevation, you saw a different landscape starting at 6,000 feet up to 14,000 feet. It was real interesting to see the changes and to and see that backcountry. So yeah, I got up Whitney. Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, I got around back there. It was
fun.
It was fun. And since then, so that was, I had not done any kind of recreation in the Sierra before I got the Sequoia job. So I got hooked, and I have been doing backpacking trips in the Sierra in the fall pretty much most of the last 10 years every fall. I'm sure I missed some here and there, but yeah, definitely one of my very favorite places to go backpacking still. So I that was another benefit. I got to see this great country and learn to love it, and now I've incorporated that into my own life because I was exposed to it through the Park Service. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Great. What were some of the real challenges that you had there? What were some of the difficult things you were dealing with?
Let me think. I guess I remember bad stuff as much as I remember fun stuff. Let me think. Well, there was a few personnel challenges. Not that there was anybody that was awful, but there was. You know, some people were better employees and some people were good but not as good. And so...
Well, that's got to be normal for every park.
Yeah, it is. And so you just have to... It's not really fun to be telling people during their annual review that, you know, here's some areas you can improve in and you're doing great, but let's... You know, this is something you might think about. So that was never... That was never fun, but it was part of the job. And everybody has places that they can improve, really. But there was one fella that needed a little bit more improvement than some others, so that was, you know, it was just kind of awkward or hard to give him a fair shake, but still try and make sure that he was improving.
Yeah.
So that would be one thing. Really, I don't remember. You know, probably if I was to flashback being sitting in front of my computer, I would be like, oh, I'm sitting in front of a computer. So there was probably that was a something that was got old at certain times. But I just don't remember. I just don't remember that many downsides to it. It was hot in the summer. I was living down at Three Rivers outside the main entrance into the park, and it got stinking hot. There in the summer, so that was, well, you know, something you just had to contend with.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm also thinking that you probably weren't doing a whole lot of road patrol.
No, I was not doing road patrol, and I didn't really want to do road patrol, and so that could be said to be a demerit on my part that I so eagerly embraced doing all this, you know, backcountry trips, but did I embrace going out and grabbing a car and doing road patrol? No, I didn't really have an interest in doing that. And I just thought, that's not what I'm strong at anyway. I was never like the best road patroller on earth. And I had some road patrol people that worked, you know, in the sub-districts that were really good. I mean, they knew what they were doing and they did a good job. And I'm like, I'm just letting them go because they're good at it. So, no, I didn't do road patrol. I don't think I ever had a response. Oh, you know, I did help with a transport or two of a someone that was arrested who was a female, and the road patrol fellow wanted me to go along to be a female in the car with him while we were transporting. And it's usually good to have two officers transport anyway into the jail in Visalia, I guess. I did that a couple times.
How far was that distance?
Well, I think it was 40 minutes or so.
Okay.
Not a long.
Yeah, not that long, but.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if I got involved with any kind of medical stuff. I did get involved with something. Another thing that was kind of interesting, and I don't feel like it was a bad thing, except it was kind of a sad occasion. There's a book out called The Last Season, which is a story that's very well written, by the way, about a ranger in Sequoia, a backcountry ranger, who around the 90s, I think it was like 1997 or 8, went missing. And they searched for him, and Debbie Bird, my boss, was there when they were searching for him. They didn't find them, and they had no idea what happened to him. He just disappeared from his patrol cabin and was not seen. And so while I was working at Sequoia, maybe a couple years, maybe like the second year I was there, his body was found. And I think that was 5 years after he had disappeared.
Wow.
His body was found up in the high country. He had gone hiking cross country in early spring. And this, I remember he fell in an area where snow was covering a creek. And I think he got underneath the snow. And could not get out, something along those lines. And he wasn't right on the main trail. He was off trail. So somebody found a part of him, a boot with a bone in it or something like that. And so park staff went back there. I don't remember who did gathered it up, but they found a shirt with his name on it. So they figured out that this is what happened to the ranger. And Debbie was real, she wanted to handle it in a nice, in an appropriate and personal manner. The backcountry rangers that live back in Sequoia and Kings Canyon, some of them have been doing that job for up in the 20s, 25 years. And they knew each other, and sometimes they would walk to each other's cabin and visit, on a day off or on top of the call. So they got to be a very close group of people in the backcountry that watched out for each other and had a lot of longevity with working in that area. Sure, there was new people now and then, but they all cared about, or a good portion of them cared about this fellow who had gone missing and was one of them, and now his body has been found. So Debbie Bird wanted to gather them up. She called into the backcountry and said, everybody in Sequoia, hike to Crabtree, which is on the west side of Mount Whitney. It's more central, on this date, and be there, and we're gonna get together, and I'm gonna give you the news about so and so and tell you everything I can, and we'll all be together when we discuss, what's been found out. And so I flew back with her. I hadn't been there when he went missing, but it was my district. So we both flew into Crabtree, and she kind of had this meeting with the rangers that were there and told them everything she knew about the finding of the body and what they felt it signified. So that was not a joyous occasion. It was probably more painful for Debbie because she had been involved with the original search and everything. But it was, I thought she handled it really well to do this notification in person to the rangers and talk to them about it. And so I was happy to be I was kind of along for the ride because I hadn't been involved with it that much that date, but so that's not really a bad thing, but it is a bad thing, but it was not something that was painful to me personally.
Well, it's a bad thing that was handled well.
Right.
And I'm assuming that there was quite a service.
You know, I imagine there was, but I can't remember anymore. I just remember that we gathered as a group and everybody was there for everybody to say, mm-hmm. oh, okay, this is what happened. Now, I can't remember, you know, if there was a service or whether that was kind of the service, which would have been what he would have wanted, something in the backcountry.
Yeah, with his peers.
Right, right. And maybe there was an aspect of that afternoon, that gathering, that was a service. I'm sure there were elements of mourning and respect given there, but I don't remember anything else. But we also had marijuana grows in the park that the staff would go out on and take down, and it was very dangerous because it could have been booby-trapped or people could have been there. And one time I went with the people that were going out more regularly, so I was all paramilitary with them, and we snuck in and gave the little hand signals about look to your left and be quiet and hunker down and all that kind of stuff. Fortunately, there was nobody that was in the marijuana garden in the national park when we arrived, and so the crews took down harvested all the marijuana, it got all helicoptered out, it got all burned up, there was irrigation lines around, but it was really an eye-opener as to the extent and degree of alteration to the park. They would trim they had the trees that would be over the marijuana, but not as thickly over oak trees, so they would take out half the branches so that they were still screened, but sunlight could get through.
Oh, interesting.
It was on super steep hills.
Huh.
And we would have little, what is it called, when you build terraces, little kind of terraces that were for each plant on the hill. And they strung black irrigation hose from a spring that was a quarter mile away and brought water down into it. And then they had fertilizers and all kinds of stuff there that they would apply, and they would have people who were living out there, apparently, maybe, I don't know, a mile off the road, but so screened in and so steep a terrain that you just would never expect. It just looked like wild land. So it was, there was a lot of marijuana being grown in the Sierra foothills on the west side. The Forest Service, there was huge task force that were multi-agency that were working together to try and maintain control eradicate it.
I imagine the DEA would be in on that?
Yep, DEA was in on that. But we had a law enforcement specialist, and he was the point person on dealing with the other agencies on that issue. And then some of the road patrol and law enforcement rangers that were in the park in the different sub-districts would get recruited to go out with him and raid these gardens. And I was usually never a participant, but I did want to go out and see what it was about. So I did go out with him on one time so I could understand it. A lot of poison oak out there, which didn't make life any better.
Oh, wow.
Creep along through the bushes. And one of the sub-district rangers was just totally allergic to poison oak, and yet he was one of the best guys to be going out there. He just had great skills, and he always would go, and then he'd come home and strip off and wash his whole body in Tecnu and put all his clothes real carefully into a plastic bag, and he'd still break out in poison oak. So
wow.
There's all kinds of different challenges to that.
Did the Kings Canyon and Sequoia, did they share a helicopter?
Yeah. It was really a wildland fire helicopter.
Oh, okay.
It was used by the fire staff, contracted it, and it was for their use. But when they didn't need it, which was oftentimes, they would the ranger staff or whoever needed it could use it for whatever they needed it for. But they were the lead people on the contracting it. And yes, so I think it was not owned. You know, the parks just all the government vehicles and planes are owned by, what is it, OAS,
right.
Aircraft Safety, and they lease it to parks. And so, yeah, but we had one that was assigned to the Cray at Kings Canyon with our little heliport. And there was a lot of activity for that helicopter because it would take the food out to the backcountry rangers, got involved in rescues in the backcountry, got involved with monitoring after thunderstorms for wildland fire, got involved with fighting wildland fire, got involved with taking marijuana out of different rural places. So, yeah, it was well utilized.
You know, I was thinking about Grand Canyon. They, you know, the park has a helicopter, but they also have, you know, two helicopters, one of which they lease from the commercial helicopter tour companies. And I think there is an arrangement there for the park ship as well. But I'm thinking, I don't know about Kings Canyon Sequoia. Did they have commercial helicopter tours going on there?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember. I don't remember that we did have them. The problem up in the air was the nearby on the east side Air Force Base, and the pilots that would like to fly low over, you know, down some canyon coming off the Sierra to practice flying low down some canyon.
Right.
And it was not in keeping with what the purpose of the park was, and yet the Park Service did not have authority to say, you can't do that, you know, you're below a certain threshold because we don't control airspace over
right.
the parks.
Right, FAA does that.
Yes. So the park had a big outreach to the generals at the Air Force Base and would invite them on backcountry trips into the backcountry for a couple days. All park sponsored. The park would have horses for them and park rangers who could, or the wranglers who could bring in the stock mules that would bring all the food in, and try to let the Air Force or the Air Force staff higher-ups experience what being in the park backcountry was all about.
Hmm.
And if we were lucky, then an airplane would fly low over, and they would get to hear, you know, what an intrusion that was into backcountry. So, and it was successful. They negotiated with the Air Force to limit where the planes were going and how low they came down over the park. So it worked out well. But I don't remember that there were helicopter tours.
Okay. Yeah, that's that low-flying military aircraft, of course. Those men and women flying those machines need to train somewhere. But,
right.
You know, the parks are trying to preserve, you know, ecologically intact, large swaths of land. So it's quite a balancing act there.
And, you know, one of the things that the Park Service has gotten, they've started acknowledging is some resources that they want to protect that are not what comes to mind right off the bat, like resources like the sequoia trees or a certain geology or things that parks are known for. And in Big Bend, I first came aware of this, and my visit to recently to Big Bend brought it back. Big Bend specifically states that they manage the park, try to manage the park for dark skies, but also for natural soundscapes.
Right.
And when you're in Big Bend, there's no plane overflights there.
Oh, wow.
And you don't hear a thing if you are away from any kind of a road. It's just all natural sounds.
Wow.
You don't understand or recognize sometimes how limited, how few of the places are that you can go and only hear natural sounds in the 24-hour period.
That's right.
There's almost always planes flying overhead somewhere.
Yep, that's right. Yeah.
And
no, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Who was your superintendent?
Dick Martin. And, I enjoyed working for Dick.
What do you remember about him?
Well, he loved being in the backcountry himself. himself, so he totally got protecting. He understood my interest in going in the backcountry, not that he ever really inquired about it, but I know he was the same kind of ranger when he was, before he was a superintendent. He would have wheedled his way into backcountry as much as he could, and he still did as superintendent. He would go on the, he took staff trips into the backcountry probably once a year, but he would go on those trips with the military, and he liked the backcountry a lot. He had been a ranger, I think, in Sequoia or Kings Canyon out of Bishop when he was a younger ranger, and loved to ski back there, was a big hiker. He didn't use stock as much, but he totally supported the backcountry operations. He looked for money to replace some aging backcountry ranger stations, and got that into a funding cycle, and they finally got funded. So he liked to watch out for the backcountry.
Nice.
So I think he was real resource oriented. I knew him, he knew me, and actually we're still on friendly terms, and he and his wife have come to Bend to visit and to ski before and stayed at my house.
Cool.
So, we're on good terms, but I didn't do much directly with him when I was working there because he had his own issues he was working on. And,
right.
We'd be sometimes at meetings at the same times, and
right.
I could see him get a little exasperated over one thing or another, but mostly he was, I think his values were good for a Park Service superintendent.
Nice, good.
I don't think there was anybody from Grand Canyon or other places that I knew in Sequoia. It's kind of funny how certain groups of people will, the Sierra people who work in the Sierra seem to kind of mix up in the Sierras a lot. Maybe Yosemite goes to Sequoia goes to Yosemite or Kings Canyon. Not that it's totally exclusive, but people kind of seem to sometimes circulate in those kind of circles. The Northern Rockies, Glacier, Yellowstone, there's rangers that sort of seem to be there, rangers that circulate around Alaska, rangers that circulate around desert parks a little bit. And it's not, certainly isn't totally a closed bowl there, but I didn't know people in Yosemite or Sequoia or Kings Canyon when I went there. I can't remember knowing anybody.
Right. It's you know, in these oral history interviews, it seems like it sort of ebbs and flows. And you come in 2001, well, that meant you missed, 7 years earlier, 8 years earlier, Nancy Melody Meekum, who had, been doing a ton of work in Death Valley and was doing, EMS and law enforcement interpretation, but Sequoia was her go-to, seasonal park, and she ended up at Grand Canyon. And so, people do move around, and either, you're there when they're there, or you're there when they're not.
And it's interesting because I did know her name, probably more from Grand Canyon. I'm not sure I ever met her, but I knew of her, and part of it might have been maybe I heard her name also at Sequoia. So it's that people have gone before you, you pick up on those names sometimes, and you never know who comes after you that goes, oh, Pat Gradigan, I remember I heard, knew her somewhere,
We were at Fletsy together or something like that, Yeah.
You move on and you just kind of are in your new space and you don't really know who's following you there. But, when I got there, I don't remember knowing people there.
Yeah, nice. And you were there for how long? That's quite.
I was there for just about 3 years.
Okay.
And I, at the age of 50, say I think I was there when I was 46 to 49 maybe. And at the age of 50, I was eligible to retire with a law enforcement 20-year retirement. I was kind of interested in retiring because Not that I didn't really enjoy my work with the Park Service, but there were so many other things that I wanted to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be able to allocate my time towards other things besides just work. And so I had kind of geared myself to retire when I was 50. But when I was 48 or 49, late 48 maybe, this chief ranger job at Redwood National Park came open. And I remember thinking, huh. And it was a great hire. I could get one more grade, which is what your retirement's all based out of.
Right.
I would get to be a chief ranger, and it was like, huh, that sounds kind of interesting. Well, what the heck? I'll just throw my hat, my name in that hat and see what comes of that. So I did apply for it, and I did get selected for that job. So I was at Sequoia 3 years with contemplating maybe just retiring from there, but I was offered the job at Redwood, I think, when I was 49, and I said, okay, well, I guess I'll work a little past 50.
How does this work? So if you've put in 20 years in law enforcement, is it you have to retire or you can retire?
When you've put in 20 years, you're eligible to retire at the age of 50.
Okay.
You must retire out of law enforcement at the age of 57.
Oh, okay.
So they don't want old farts running around with guns.
Right.
And stumbling and shooting somebody.
Right.
You know, that's the basic mentality.
Sure. And there's, you know, it's a lot of training, and you have to, you know, agility and run and
right.
You know, it's physically demanding.
Yeah.
And all the stuff you have to carry when you have to put your duty belt on with your,
right.
You know, with your
right.
Bulletproof
right.
vest and all that stuff. So.
Yeah. But some people who are park law enforcement, who are law enforcement rangers, as they approach their mid-50s, if they don't really want to retire yet because they like working in the Park Service and they want to keep working, they will just get out of a law enforcement job.
Mm-hmm.
So someone might go from being a chief ranger to a superintendent, and they're no longer a law enforcement ranger.
Right.
So they are out of law enforcement by the time they're 57, but they're still working for the Park Service.
Right. So they lose their commission.
Yeah, they lose their commission, but they always have those 20 years of
right.
credit towards
oh, yeah.
their retirement. Yes.
You bet. You
right.
bet.
They lose their commission.
So right. you don't want to become a law enforcement ranger when you're 38.
Right. As a matter of fact, you can't.
Okay. I was going to say, work out the math and go, it's not going to work. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
And like I said, I had just determined somewhere along the line that I wasn't that interested in being a superintendent because, honestly, I saw superintendents working long hours and going to Elks Club meetings on Saturdays, and I always liked my free time,
mm-hmm.
and I always liked taking vacations and going to interesting places, and I didn't want to become wed to the Park Service so much that I no longer had my own personal life.
Right.
And so I identified that, yeah, I did want to retire young and go do the other things I wanted to do. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was my basic plan, and I did retire when I was 52, so I was still on the young side when I retired, but I overshot my goal of 50 by a couple of years.
Not bad. Not bad. Yeah. Well, maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series here, and in part 10, we will see how the transition went from Sequoia to Redwood.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to add into this section before I wrap things up?
I can't think of anything.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part 9 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Pat Gredigan. Today is Friday. It's March 5th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Pat, thank you so very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.